Piano Jazz Rising Stars explores the spirit of artistic innovation today and introduces the jazz legends of tomorrow. This program is made possible by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Friends of Piano Jazz, and NPR.
Hi, I'm John Weber. My guest today is the incredibly talented guitarist Julian Lage. He got his start with Gary Burton's band, performed on the Grammy Awards at age 12, and his debut album, Sounding Point, was nominated for a Grammy in 2010. All this from a man born in 1987. His latest album of all original music, Gladwell, was released this year, and I'm excited to hear all about this latest project. Julian Lage, welcome to Piano Jazz Rising Stars.
Thank you so much for having me.
When you were going on 5 years old, now this is the age at which most of us are learning to maneuver a big wheel on the sidewalk somewhere.
Sure.
Do you remember what initially attracted you toward the instrument which would profoundly shape your future?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I remember being, about 4 years old, and it was around the time that Eric Clapton's Unplugged came on MTV. It was like a big deal, and it was a wonderful concert, wonderful record. And my father was so inspired by that that he got a guitar. That was kind of what did it. He's always been a music fan and had played some when he was much younger. So I remember my father getting a guitar and being absolutely in love with it. And me just kind of hanging around him going, I wish I could do that. And just basically bugging my parents for about a year for a guitar. And at a certain point they said, you know, absolutely, if in a year you still want it, we'll make it happen. And that was it. I mean, I remember my father made a cutout from a piece of plywood of a Telecaster. And he painted all the frets and the strings on it and the pickup and the knobs. And basically, I just carried that around the house for about a year, just pretending like I was a guitar player.
Before you even had a working guitar, you
Before,
had a
yeah.
sort of a...
It was like,
a,
yeah, like a, this wonderful kind of toy, but it was... I just love the aesthetic of it, you know, and I think on a personal level it's just such a wonderful way to interact with my father. You know, this was a creative venture that we could both kind of be obsessed with, and in retrospect I see how profound that was for me.
Wow. Well, how soon were you picking out melodies on a guitar?
Well, it's funny, the first day I got a guitar, my father, he told me to go to my bedroom, he said, there might be something for you, and sure enough there was a Fender Stratocaster. Is beautiful. I was like, it gives me chills thinking about it. It was so perfect. And what was so hip is right away he said, I want to show you what I've been learning at the lessons, because he had been taking lessons. And what it was basically a blues scale. And he said, here's the deal. If you learn this scale and maybe these two or three locations, anything you play in it is going to be right. And he would play blues progressions and I would just improvise. His logic years later, he told me, he said, you know, if I showed you a song, you could have played it right or wrong. And if it was wrong, you might be discouraged. And I didn't want you to be discouraged. So he said, if I gave you kind of like this improvisational paradigm, you could do anything. So I lived in that zone for the first year of just trying to play along, picking things out by ear. But it was all very fleeting and really enjoyable.
That's so wise. What a
yeah.
wonderful way to encourage you to begin playing the instrument, probably in earnest. I imagine you probably spent hours.
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't let go of it. And it was, I feel like it shaped definitely how I look at all of this today, for sure.
Alone together with your guitar.
Absolutely.
I want to hear you play something on your guitar.
That sounds great. How about I play... Actually, Alone Together would be perfect.
There you go. There you go.
There you have it.
There you go.
You know, in the last couple of years, I've been making a concerted effort to be more comfortable with solo guitar music, and I feel like this song is the perfect kind of vehicle to play around with improvisation, also something from the jazz history. And yeah, so here we go.
I love it. Thank you. Julian, what a sound.
Thank you, man.
It's just a miracle to watch you, and it's your tasteful harmony, your space, your rhythm, your invention on this great song, Alone Together.
I really appreciate that. Thank
you. What a conversation. You know, you and your guitar, you were very soulful and serious. And, I mean, while you're creating some fantastic solo, really into it, just like now, you're just sort of smiling and you're very matter-of-fact about your skill. Profoundly musical and completely conversational. It's just that's, I mean, you always seem to comfortably adapt to whatever environment you happen to be in. And I want you to talk about an expression I've heard you use, which is, my environment is my guru.
Right.
Even when your environment consists of just a particular musical situation or a particular guitar, I'm thoroughly tantalized by this expression. Tell me how it applies to you.
Oh, well, that, you know, I think that that definitely is something I kind of model a lot of my actions around, which is this thought that, you know, so often I catch myself pushing to make, you know, make an agenda, to get better, to achieve more, to do whatever. And what I'm starting to learn is that as effective as that can be, if it's not necessitated by the people around you or the actual present moment, if your actions aren't born out of the present, that you can feel, you know, it's almost like you're sitting on top of life while everything just kind of moves organically underneath you. And I just keep catching myself going, oh, okay, can this room inform me? You know, can this be my teacher? Can I, you know, I don't know, can I really let myself be moved? And for performers especially, I think that's essential because there's a lot of pressure. You know, though I came up in a very nurturing family and with wonderful musicians, there's a pressure to be on, you know, and to play great and really kind of kill it. And I guess I'm starting to realize the beauty in that, you know, even if I drop my guard and I just receive the, you know, the sense of the strings on my fingers or the sound of the instrument or the room or the feedback of the audience, that the performance will kind of do itself, you know. So that's my take on that. Because when, you know, playing a piece like Alone Together, what I'm always kind of obsessed, and maybe I shouldn't get off topic too much, but with the psychology of what goes through your head when you're playing this music. And there's always that wonderful voice of, you know, judgment that's kind of sitting there going, that wasn't cool, or you could be better. And I'm currently in a place where I'm just kind of seeing that arise and say, oh, I'm not going to react. I'm going to let it keep going.
There's an amazing calm about you, sort of a welcoming calm. In fact, there's even a song, Welcoming Committee, that I've heard. I want to hear you play that at some point. Maybe you could even do that next.
That would actually be super fitting. Welcoming Committee, you might dig this. I was... I think I was out with my band. We were playing last summer in Europe, doing a lot of shows. And for whatever reason, we were doing a lot of press and doing a lot of things where people wanted to just talk for like 10 minutes for little interviews. And I had this kind of this wonderful opportunity where I thought, okay, I have people's attention. You know, for whatever reason, they're looking in my direction. And my first reaction is, oh, I want to be impressive. Kind of like what I was saying earlier. I want to be good. I want to do the right thing. And then the follow-up response that I started to feel was, I want to be simple. I want to be clear. It doesn't really matter what I say. It's just what an honor to have anyone looking in your direction, interested, that, you know, maybe the best response is just to be melodic and kind of accessible in the best sense of that word. So I set out to write a song called Welcoming Committee, which was, you know, something kind of memorable. And so that was born out of that experience.
I would love to hear you play Welcoming Committee.
Oh, it would be my pleasure. I'd love to do it for you.
Julian Lage composition welcoming committee. I can't stop smiling.
Good.
I'm sitting in the room with you. I feel like I'm getting a private concert. It's so beautiful. And
thank you so much, man. It's fun. I'm having a great time.
I'm loving everything you're doing. And you've been doing this for so long. You wrote that in 2010, I want to say?
Yeah, I guess so. Now it's a little over a year ago.
It's gorgeous. You know, there's so many disciplines I hear in there in which you are very skilled. In other words, you play acoustic, and you have, I mean, even when you were a kid, I think with the musical skill of a grown-up at, say, I don't know, age 11 or so, I mean, you were consistently steered toward some extremely good-natured mentors like your fellow acoustic instrument genius, virtuoso, mandolin virtuoso, David Grisman. And I'd love to know how you started working with this great man.
I met him when I was about 10 years old at a vintage guitar show that was in the Bay Area. And what grew out of that was this beautiful relationship where David kind of took me under his wing and showed me that it's okay to merge a lot of styles. You know, he's kind of someone who came from bluegrass and acoustic music and, you know, adapted jazz and, of course, blues and pop and classical music and everything into this one thing called dog music, you know, D-A-W-G. That's kind of the staple of his sound. And he always did it with really incredible musicians around him, which was also something that at the time I didn't realize how special that was. But he basically was, you know, painting the picture that it's up to you to create your own kind of music, to play with the most creative folks you can find, and why not do it on beautiful instruments too? So I got all of this more or less through osmosis, just hanging around him, and then we recorded when I was 11. We did a duet on his record, Dog Duos, and the rest is kind of history. My favorite anecdote of that period, I mean, when I was from about 11 to 15, we played a lot together. But I remember going backstage at a Doc Watson show with him, and we played a trio version of Summertime, just myself, Grisman, and Doc Watson. And you know, at the time it felt so normal. I was like, here's this guy, Doc Watson, who I love and I've heard, but he's just a normal guy. And when I look back, I go, what a blessing to see that was acceptable, you know, for us to sit around in a circle and make music. And just moments like that kind of made for a really rich tapestry.
Yeah. Well, David also introduced you to Bela Fleck.
Exactly.
And Chris Thiel, if I'm not mistaken. The Punch Brothers, Nickel Creek.
Absolutely. Chris is dynamite. Yeah, Bela used to come through Sonoma County a lot, and I'd hang out with Grisman, and we'd go and see him play, and started playing together. And then Chris, it was funny. Chris was living in San Francisco around the time that I was playing with Grisman, and he was already, you know, fully underway with Nickel Creek and kind of, you know, a total star on the scene. And so a lot of people would say, oh, the two of you have to play. You know, it'd just be great. You're young, you're, you know, precocious, you're into this stuff. And for whatever reason, it never happened. Scheduling never worked out. I would always be at a show and someone would say, oh, you just missed Chris. You two would have been great. So when it came to making my first record, Sounding Point, I was thinking, well, I want to have special guests of some sort. But I want to showcase the thing that a lot of my friends don't really know that I used to do, which is be kind of obsessed with bluegrass and folk music and acoustic music. I had somehow managed to keep it a little bit of a secret. Once I got into playing with Gary Burton's group and other groups, I was very jazz, jazz, jazz. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I thought, you know, here's my chance to show, kind of make a statement. So I called Bela and I said, you know, are you down? And he said, I'm down. I said, what if we did something with you know, Thiele? This might be perfect. And he said, yeah, this is your chance. You're going to play. So the first time we ever played together was the night before the recording. And we said, yeah, we're going to have no problem.
You have plenty of bluegrass folk compositions.
I think I have something for you. There's a song I wrote when I was finishing up at Berklee College of Music in Boston. And I was hanging out with a lot of these incredible young acoustic musicians. I would go to these jam sessions and I always felt so unprepared because I basically didn't know enough of the tradition, but I didn't have any compositions to offer. So I'll play a song for you now that is called Gray Lighting, and it's basically in honor of all those wonderful people I got to hang out with in Boston.
I would love to hear you play Gray Lighting. This is a new one to me.
Absolutely. I'd love to play it for you. Thank you.
Gray lighting, fantastic. So visual. I thought about a fiddle player. You said it was a fiddle song. Tell me about that.
Well, it's funny. Gray lighting, the term, I think I found out about it on Wikipedia or something. It referred to fiddle players who would play in the streets. They'd play all night and come around 5 a.m. or dawn when the light's changing, when the light is kind of gray. They would dig into their bag of alternate tunings that maybe weren't the ones that would make the most money, but they were hip. So gray lighting refers to that secret stash of musical ideas that is off the beaten path, but still, you know, something you're proud of.
Well, you have a million reasons to be proud of that, and I love it, and I can't wait until
you
record it.
Thank you. I know this is the first time it'll go out into the world, so hopefully it'll come out again.
Well, there's more in a moment with guitarist Julian Lage. Our program is made possible in part by a grant from NPR and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art works. I'm John Weber, and this is Piano Jazz Rising Stars from NPR Music. Julian, your album Sounding Point, your debut Grammy-nominated Best Contemporary Jazz Record, is one of the most intriguing, enchanting debut records I've ever heard. And even the meaning of the title, Sounding Point, is a double meaning. It's very clever. I'd love you to talk about that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Sounding Point, when I first heard that phrase, it was in reference to actually a classical musician friend of mine. She was talking about on the violin and how, depending where you put the bow on the string, you're going to get a different tone production. And same with guitar, right? Where if you're plucking it closer to the bridge, it'll be a little trebly-er, more trebly. And then if you're closer to the other side of the guitar, you'll get a little warmer, bassier sound. And she was describing to me the meaning and how it related to this particular concept. And I thought, you know, that's kind of in essence what I'm going for with this first record, which is, you know, there's a lot of sounding points. You know, there's a lot of seemingly disjunct parts of the record, you know, from the solo stuff I do to my group stuff, it was important to see that I was the connector, you know. I was the string between all of that.
They all sound like you, and I'd love for you to talk about your quintet.
Absolutely.
Because that's it's truly one of the most original, adventurous configurations I've ever heard, and you make it work. Talk about the guys in your band and how you met.
Absolutely. No, I'm passionately in love with this band, this group of musicians. We started about 3 or 4 years ago, and the band actually originated with a relationship I had with our saxophonist in the first version of the group, Ben Rozeth. And we had taught a little bit together out of the Stanford Jazz Workshop, and we were just friends and loved playing together. Terrific musician, one of my all-time favorites. And as our relationship kind of grew, he introduced me to a couple of his friends, one of which was Jorge Roeder, our bassist. And then I, in a way, stumbled into a recording contract. I say stumbled into it because I had the music and the overall concept together, but I didn't have the band, so I had to work fast. I called Ben, he was into it. I called Jorge, he was certainly into it. And I thought, well, what is it kind of missing? What do I need to fulfill the orchestration I want? And I went right to cello, actually. I thought, you know, cello, I thought, well, this would be a wonderful instrument if I want to do anything rooted in classical music or drawing on, you know, music from Astor Piazzolla. Basically, I wanted to put together a band that would do things I could do with no other band. So I was lucky enough to meet a Aristides Rivas, a cellist from Venezuela.
Where they have El Sistema, which is the educational program. All the kids get instruments.
Oh, man, he came up through that. He came up with, Gustavo Dudamel. And they're just kind of known for extremely passionate, fiery, virtuosic musicians. And Aristides is no exception. He's fantastic. And then the last kind of piece of the puzzle was Tupac Mantilla, who is our percussionist from Bogota, Colombia.
Plays cajon.
Cajon. This is where I first... He totally kills. And the cajon is an instrument I first heard in flamenco music, and it seemed like a timbrely, a good fit for cello, sax, and...
It's a box you sit on, you play with your fingertips, right? It's kind of quieter than a drum set.
Exactly, way quieter. That was one of my rules. I said, I don't want anything that's going to really clash frequency-wise with the strings of the guitar.
Right.
And this wooden box basically is, the perfect fit. It's kind of deep, kind of very punchy. It's almost like it has the sound of a snare, but it can be used in more orchestrational ways.
And cymbals, I would imagine, would probably clash with the sounding point of the cello.
Exactly. This was a real kind of challenge to put this band together in a creative way where I knew it would sound like a strong unit. The blessing and the thing that connects all of us is that our relationships with each other are so strong that I had to trust that anything we did would be, it would come across as loving and passionate. And that's what resulted in Sounding Point. Fast forward a couple years of touring together. Ben went on to do other things in his career, and so we were looking for new saxophonists when we got Mr. Dan Blake, who's not from South America, actually. He's from New Jersey, lives here in New York. And he plays tenor saxophone, and that's basically the newest lineup for the band.
So you have guitar, cello, alto sax, tenor sax now.
Tenor sax now,
acoustic,
yeah.
Bass, and percussion. And now, here's your bandmates come from a vastly different musical tradition than you grew up with here in North America. You grew up jamming on, giant steps. and they probably didn't.
Yeah, but you're so right. There's a huge folk tradition that they all came up through.
Well, what did you have in common with these great young musicians? And did you meet them there, or did they meet you here?
Well, that's a great question. We met when I was basically just going to Berklee College of Music. This was back in 2006, 2007, right in there. And they were all at New England Conservatory and on their way out, graduating. And it just kind of was it just so happened that they were from South America, but it was never a deliberate choice. And the funny thing is that it's like you say in the question, we basically didn't have a common ground of material. So we've never played, All the Things You Are together. We've never played a blues together. We've never played any jazz tunes.
Wow.
And I think I purposely did that to myself to say, well, we got to create this from the ground up. If we have improvisation as a commonality, we have a love for each other that's a commonality. So we basically just need some musical architecture that we can live in. But it's funny. I almost think of the straight ahead jazz world as something that I only get to do with, other people. So I miss it at times.
Well, I would love to play a straight ahead tune with you.
Yeah.
If we could, it's just
I'd
you and me.
It.
I could, we could do, I don't know, I Remember You.
Perfect. I love that song. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Thank you. Wow, you sound great on I Remember You.
Man, it's such a pleasure to play with you. So easy. Like, you just kind of set me up.
Well, you probably, I would imagine that you're playing your own music a lot, and maybe, I don't know how often you get to a jam session like this, and shed a tune.
It's surprisingly infrequent. It's funny because I don't get to play standards that much anymore. So many of these songs, especially the older jazz tunes, they're so rich and so dramatic and so evocative, and it's really fun to play with you and kind of get into that space of what you do with a standard.
Oh, likewise, man. There is a comfort zone about playing standards. We love playing our own stuff, but there is, every once in a while, you find an old standard, an old chestnut, and you just start playing it. Oh, God, I forgot. Man.
Yeah,
these
yeah.
No wonder these tunes were built to last.
Exactly. It's funny. I recently, a friend of mine called me and she said, you got to check out this YouTube link. It's amazing. It's a song called Sleepy Time Gal, and it's incredible. It's totally your song. And so I look it up and I'm embarrassed that I didn't know this standard before. I don't know. Maybe I could give that a shot for you.
I want to hear you do it.
I'll give it a shot. Thank you.
Wow, Julian, what amazing, tasteful, beautiful chords. I love every note.
Thank you. It's a beautiful piece, right? It's really, I don't know, it's just kind of haunting how well it works if you just kind of let it play itself. I think, truth be told, that's kind of where I want to get better, where I struggle a little bit, is that how to reconcile the fact that, you know, in jazz, we're kind of expected to and encouraged to improvise and take chances and invent new things. But at the same time, really honor something as beautiful as Sleepy Time Gallery, one of these older pieces.
Yeah, when you're playing solo, I mean, you really are condensing everything. You're just distilling it down to your 10 fingers and whatever they can do.
Yeah.
And sometimes you take an orchestra. In other words, mm-hmm. I mean, I know you love Bernard Herrmann and all the film people.
Yeah, of course.
I'm crazy about Herrmann, and I'm also crazy about Eric Korngold, my God.
Oh, my God. What a amazing musician.
He only did 19 films for Warner Brothers, but he was one of these guys who got started really young like you, too. I mean, he was writing for a large orchestra by the time he was, you know, 9 or 10.
Wow.
And, you know, I would like to play something for you from one of his films.
Oh, I would love that. What are you going to play?
The Prince and the Pauper, which he did in 1937, one of the many films he scored for Warner Brothers. And I think this was a Mark Twain story starring Errol Flynn.
Very cool.
This is The Prince and the Pauper.
Man, that was awesome. I loved it. I loved hearing you play that song, and your touch is, you know, I was sitting there kind of drooling over the fact that everything was so precise and clear and had sustain. It's like, yeah, you killed it.
Well, Julian, watching you play for an hour and listening to you do all of those things, my God, and your walking chords on Sleepy Time Gale made me feel like doing that on The Prince and the Pauper as well. I like that.
That I thought was so hip how you did that. You know, as a guitar player, we kind of struggle with, you know, having chords moving without being too clunky and still having a melody on top.
Well, you said the key word, melody. In other words, we're always searching for great melody somewhere. And, you know, it was a written piece. It was a symphonic score.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you're no stranger to the world of written pieces. I mean, you've done 13 marvelous etudes that I know that you are doing in your fantastic YouTube series.
That's right. Yeah.
And what are you up to now about...
It's pathetic. I've only posted the first four, but I have others in the works. And, that's kind of dealing with exactly what we're talking about, which is I wanted to write a series of guitar pieces that basically challenge me and push me to refine some of these things that I hear other players do but don't quite know how to practice them.
Yeah.
So each one embodies a different kind of skill set that I want to get better at.
Oh, you're more skilled than anybody I know. So I want to watch you do one of these etudes.
I could do that. Let me try. I'll do the first one, which is kind of my favorite right now. And yeah, this one's designed to have that motion, that movement in the left right hand, and have kind of a singing melody that emerges on top. So I'd
Excellent.
Love to give it a shot.
Here's Julian Lage's etude number one. Wow, Julian, I love that. Every time I hear that etude number one, I just think, oh, my God.
Thank you,
man. It's physically impossible, and I'm icing my hand down just watching you do it. It's so nice, and,
Thank you. And
I can't wait to hear the other 12.
Absolutely. There's more on the way.
Well, it's a pity that this hour has gone by so quickly.
It flew by, John.
I can't believe we have so much more to talk about. I'm going to come to all your gigs.
Please do. Let's hang out after this. Come on. It'd be great.
Well, let's do one more tune, maybe another standard. What do you think, a nice swinger maybe?
Yeah. You know, I've been enjoying playing Just Friends. What about that?
I love it.
Okay, we'll just go for it.
Julian, you're fantastic, man.
Thank you. Man, thank you so much. It's such a treat to be here and play with you and just the whole hang. It's been great.
Thank you.
This has been Piano Jazz Rising Stars with host John Weber and his guest Julian Lage. Piano Jazz Rising Stars is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio and was recorded at Tainted Blue Studios in New York City, with post-production in the Elaine T. Freeman Suite at ETV Radio in Columbia, South Carolina. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, recording engineer Duke Marcos, mastering engineer David Mitchell, production manager Grant Jackson. The executive producer is Kobe Hennessy. Special thanks to Thurston Briscoe of WBGO and Joey Kahn of KPLU. To find out more about the artists and music selections, visit our website at scetv.org/pianojazzrisingstars. Support for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Friends of Piano Jazz. Additional support comes from NPR stations and NPR. Contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting research on how social factors like housing and jobs affect health. Learn more at rwjf.org. This is NPR.